My name is Klaus Hostel, and I'm the director of the College of Extraordinary Experiences. You're listening to the Business of Extraordinary Experiences. Today, we'll be talking about professional relationship building, Anna Carone. And with me, I have an expert who I'm happy to introduce. Chris Bramley is not only a TEDx speaker, but he's also a man who doesn't really like shortened sentences. Not only is his job title on LinkedIn, coach slash consultant slash mentor in agile slash lean, sign of fin, complex teaching, learning slash more, but, and Chris, you may hate me for this, but I took it from your own page. When it says, what do you do at your job? Not only was I impressed, I was also a little bit confused because, and I quote here, you hear, I specialize in an adaptive, holistic ecosystem of frameworks, including Cinefin complexity, agile slash lean, context dowsing, strategic paradigms, and much more to enhance management, innovation, disruption, value delivery, and communication in organizations from startups, SMBs to SME, global enterprise, civil clients. Wow. Chris, welcome to the show. And I'm sorry for that, but it was too fun not to do, especially because I know I've watched your TED Talk. It's excellent. I've seen some of what you've done online. And you're, if nothing else, you are a sharp man when it comes to getting people to meet at a workplace, probably also in real life. But your focus, from what I understand, is kind of this workplace meeting. I sense that it's not about speaking in short sentences here. Therefore, the slight tease at the opening. Tell us, what is professional relationship building? Let's start there.
Okay, so I think to understand the fundamentals of professional relationships, we actually have to look at how humans operate as social creatures. So everything we do professionally actually is something we do personally as well. But we like to segregate, we like to draw a line. This is old school, you know, work, right? You have your work persona and your home persona. Now, what I find interesting is that there is, in modern times, there's quite a blurring of the boundaries there, because now people have a brand that maintains, you know, its brand across every single platform. So kind of with millennial and post-millennial generational mindsets, there are differences. But in essence, your professional relationships are similar to your personal ones. And I said it in my TEDx, so you probably heard, but there are four main foundations, I believe, that any relationship needs to have, and this includes professional relationships. So you need to have a form of love or respect. You need to have trust to effectively be able to have that relationship sustainably. You need to have honesty, which is the flip side to trust, of course. But the fourth one is the most important, because it's about true mutual communication. And without that, none of the others can actually really exist. And so to have professional relationships that sustainably work between companies, between people within the companies, between the strata of you know, business levels from leadership on down, essentially, all of those things really need to be implicit within that relationship for it to work correctly, I believe.
And I agree. I mean, how could anyone not agree? What does that look like on a kind of low key? What does that look like, not on an everyday basis, because I know you do a lot of different things, but when you're working with a client, with a company of some sort, what does that look like in the kind of nitty gritty?
The simplest expression of the, and I'm going to use a Kinevin term here, the complexity term, entanglement, right? The entanglement of social complexity within a workplace is really expressed very well by something very simple that we talk about, but we often don't think about, and that is culture. And I don't just mean, you know, the culture that you come from, or even the company culture. Companies have intra-company cultures between departments and types of people. And so all of these cultures kind of combine into these relationships. And you don't really think about it consciously a lot of the time.
No, and one of the reasons that I wanted to talk with you about this is because I do a lot of like culture design, behavior design, that sort of thing. And I was fascinated not only by, when I saw your stuff, not only by your obvious passion and kind of this is something you really believe in. This is not just a shtick. Of course, nobody will say it is, but it's very clear once you watch any of Chris's stuff that this is, there's some dedication there. But also because I have to admit, I was intrigued that one of the things that I find happens a lot in this sort of culture building is that we try to slim down the complex and make it simple. And that's also why I took the, shall we say, rather teasing opening, which had both respect, trust, and honesty, and so on. But if there's one thing that I found fascinating with the small glimpse I've had of your work is that you're not afraid to keep the complex complex.
No, and in fact, I think that you have to. So a lot of people see this as uncomfortable because, of course, it is. And you know, we try to bring order to things that don't seem to have order. This is a very human trait. And so I think it's crucial to understand that, yes, we can manage complicated or ordered or, you know, clear situations. But just because something is complex, it doesn't mean that you cannot manage it. You just have to manage it differently. And a very good example of this is given by Dave Snowden, who is the chief scientific officer of Cognitive Edge. He's the guy who came up with Kinevan and complex adaptive systems theory in that respect. And he talks about a children's party. And where at work you might say, okay, we're in a factory, so this is a very waterfall environment. We need to have phased approaches. We need to have procedures that are done before the other procedures can take place, blah, blah, blah. That's fine. If you're organizing a children's party, you don't bring them in and say, okay, we're going to sit down. We're going to have a planning session. We're going to discuss the motivation for this. We're going to put posters up on the wall that are motivating you. What appraisals are we going to have afterwards to determine the success criteria of the party and whatever? But you don't do that. And Dave's exact way of putting it is the only way you can deal with it is you draw a line in the sand and you say, cross that, you little bastards, and you die. Anything else is acceptable because it is a complex and unordered system. And if you try to order it, anyone who has children and has tried to order them will understand why that doesn't really work.
I actually made part of my early living doing children's parties, so children's birthday parties. So I know what you're speaking of firsthand. And I'm tempted to dive more into this, and we will, but this is more to get an intro before we talk about Corona. And tell me, how is, in kind of broad strokes, not just the children's birthday party, but this whole establishing this, how has that changed during Corona? Because your work must have changed a lot, I would guess.
Yeah, what I found has been very interesting is a paradigm shift. And this is something that I and a number of other people have been working for years. And when coronavirus hit, it essentially exponentially accelerated this dive into this, you know, nouveau agile way of working, the brave new world, right, that we've been moving towards for a while. 5 years ago, we couldn't have possibly achieved what we have today with the ability to work remotely and in the cloud and so forth. So my work has changed, but what I found particularly ironic and amusing is the fact that a lot of companies are trying to deal with the change by acting as they always have because it's comfortable. So they've increased command and control. They've made even more cuts. Now, the one thing that they need to do is get experts in outside context to help them find certainty in uncertainty and find a way to find emergent new opportunities and better goals within this complex environment, because that's what coronavirus is. It started out as chaos, crisis management, but that can't last forever. So we've now lapsed into this new normal, right? We've collapsed down, if you like, into a kind of slightly lower energy state, which is complexity. And my work has changed in a way because companies are suddenly going, what is this complexity stuff that you've been talking about for ages? It actually, now it sounds quite important. But on the other side, they're also saying, and nobody wants to pay you because we've made cuts. And I'm like, well, one of those things has to change. If you want to find your way, you know, so I have a saying that I have in a number of my books and various other things, a number of my articles. It's hard to navigate when you're too close to the sun. Like half the universe is fire. You just can't see anything. And very often you need somebody who can either guide you back out of it or is far enough away that they can see it as a star and help you navigate to where you maybe need to go or find where you need to go. And of course, that's what the best type of, I don't like really the word consultant or coach or whatever. They get misused a lot. Advisor, somebody with outside context to help you sustainably find your own way is how I operate. I'm not there to do it for you because that's meaningless.
Would it be right to say that you, and of course you're not alone in this, have gotten a little bit more of a breakthrough in this guiding role during Corona? Because as you say, you've been saying this for years and you've not been alone in this, but now suddenly people are listening.
Yes, a lot more people are interested. However, what I have found is interesting as well is the fact that companies are more reticent to actually formally engage consultants during this time, which is understandable given the unrest and so forth. But I've actually found a lot of this has become lost in the noise. Because, of course, for a lot of consultants, this is a very difficult time, especially in the UK. Consultants have been given zero help from the government at all. And so suddenly a lot of people who weren't originally life coaches and complexity consultants appear to have evolved in a slightly Pokemon-esque manner.
So true.
and fair enough, you know, they're more than welcome to do it. But when you've been doing it for quite a while, getting lost in the noise can be a little frustrating at times. But companies are very much looking for new ways out of it. And I think a lot of them need to get to the point and have the courage to admit that just because we've always done something one way, that doesn't mean it was ever necessarily the best way, certainly not when contexts have changed. And that's where a lot of companies need to get to now. So a lot of them are open to talking. It's not a far process.
And I guess part of it, there's a Dutch acquaintance of mine, Cyril Kotleben. Cyril, if you're listening, we're now going to quote you, who has this beautiful talk about, he talks about motivation and about kind of energy at the workplace, amongst other things. And he has this lovely example of you find at work that somebody has left a banana peel on the floor. And then, of course, somebody gets a ladder and puts it up like a step ladder. And then you climb over that. And at some point, the banana peel is cleared away. But nobody removes the ladder. And what I've seen, and I hear what you say, that you've seen quite a bit of this as well, is that suddenly a lot of these ladders are becoming incredibly visible to a lot of people. That there are a lot of things that suddenly we can talk about the ladders, where before, if you came and said, why do you have these ladders all over the place? Well, when the whole place is on fire, then maybe it's a good chance to kind of move the ladders around as well. And what are a couple of these that you have seen in multiple companies and multiple organizations during the course of this corona, like things where it's like, yes, you're also doing this. Yes, you're also doing this, where there's suddenly willingness to listen where before wasn't. I know I was the one with the super long question, but I'm just as bad as you are when it comes to it, just not on LinkedIn.
I speak very limited Dutch. I used to speak the Dutch. Good example. And I think a lot of companies bring structures in that you very rarely remove things, especially if you feel that they work, even if they don't actually work. This is one of the peculiarities of bureaucracy. And I've written a couple of articles on why we need to break bureaucracy on a moved kind of different systems. Once you've established structure, especially when you get to a point where the structure is the raison d'être, you know, you're looking at bureaucracy and the bureaucracy is the point, not the outcomes the bureaucracy was built to help achieve, right? And that's a very difficult thing to remove things. Now, leadership tend to have been taught a certain way, have had experiences a certain way, and they tend to stick with what has worked in the past, which is absolutely fine. But the whole point is the context which changed. So, you know, you're talking about removing these structures and then when they become visible. I've seen that happen quite a few times where companies have said, this is a real chance, this is a radical opportunity for change. Actually, things have been okay before, but now we're doing this stuff remotely. Let's look at downside of the office. We need everyone all the time to monitor, to micromanage them, to measure their progress. Of course, this fits into the old thing of don't look very busy. If you're not busy enough, I'll give you something to do. One of the most radical changes that I've seen, there's a very interesting juxtaposition which I saw occur at the beginning of the lockdowns in plural, and that was, as we suddenly were forced to be remote and socially distance and isolate, people would sit next to people they knew in Starbucks, look at their phone and not talk humanly, suddenly realized the value of human proximity. And so human connections were vastly, they exploded, essentially. People were suddenly talking to neighbors they never talked to over the fence and talking to people online and having Zoom meetings. And of course, because humans polarize and we never do any, we're binary creatures, all or nothing. And now everyone's got Zoom fatigue and everything else because we've overdone it. And so there was that interesting kind of paradigm switch, that juxtaposition. And of course, for me, one of my driving elements actually balance comes from years of trying to balance myself. I have a lot of emotions. I have a lot of emotional intelligence, but I'm very logical. That's the analytical side of me is actually there to try to balance the rest because I do a lot about mental health and various other things. And I think that that's true in business and so forth. And of course, you know, I did years of martial arts and that helps you kind of understand a bit as well. everything requires balance really to be fully effective sustainably. You can't go all out forever. And having a balance between face-to-face and remote and the understanding that the paradigm has shifted, but that doesn't mean all of the things that we used to have. You know, some of those are still very valid and it's all about the context. I think that's one of the most important things that I've seen emerging in companies is a slow realization of this.
With that in mind, there's, I know that you're in a different space, but you must have, I assume that you've touched upon kind of the whole team building sphere and this kind of creating harmony and peak performance and that sort of thing by, I mean, there's a whole industry there. And I assume that if you haven't been actively in it, you've at least dabbled or know the space. How does that sort of thing work during Corona? It's pretty hard to go out and kayak to get to know each other or do an escape room if you're only allowed to be one person inside it.
Well, that's interesting to consider because it is really a space a lot in terms of I run team building exercises. I do as I suggest to companies ways that they can better collaborate because, of course, collaboration is one of the main things that I deal with. And I think team building can be a part of that, but it can also be a symptom treatment of causes.
Oh, sure. Agreed. Yes.
This is one of the problems. An industry is built up around team building and saying we need to be a better team where you still formalize the process, making it mandatory, you're doing these other things actually aren't building a team. They're kind of saying we're going to take up extra time of yours outside the cut, whatever it is, where informal communication in a company and allowing people to be more human. A lot of what I do is around, and this comes back to culture and communication. We're social and we're human. And we need to move away realistically from the roboticization, the componentizing of humans, and realize that actually are all individual, you know, the life of, quote, all individuals who have unique strengths and weaknesses, and we can actually collaborate very well together. A lot of team building is about alignment, and I don't like alignment as a description you hear all the time. Alignment is very dangerous because it can mean a number of things, including groupthink. Everyone do what you're told, leadership have spoken, you're aligned, or consensus culture, you're all aligned, and it's taken you 3 days to get there and nobody's made any decisions. Collaboration is different because you're not aligned, you're all invested in the outcome, which can actually be semi-autonomously towards the outcome and still be aligned and invested in whatever, but without having to have that cohesive, you know, all pieces in a lodestone aligned towards the magnetic field kind of feel about it. So I think having that kind of that element of being able to come together and work semi-autonomously. And in fact, I've been reading a very good book, which you may have heard of, called Turn the Ship Around. And it actually deals with a number of these things. And it's about the leader-leader model, not the leader-follower model, and the fact that a lot shouldn't be a requirement. I am what called in computer theory a heretic, a maverick, an outlier. A number of people I know are there as well. You don't get into an organization, you get your head lopped off, you must conform. And I actually find that organizations are losing a vast untapped potential for innovation and evolution amongst all of them. Sorry, I start to wander now. All of this is intertwined. I end up vanishing off.
No. That is good. And that's also one of the things that I find fascinating in this. And when you say, not only is it intertwined, but you said a very powerful sentence, which is you go into an organization and then you end up getting your head lopped off, which is not exactly the case. But you come in and then it's like, here's how we do things here. And on one hand, that's super necessary. Because if you go into McDonald's, you better make the burger the same way that the others do, or you're kind of killing off what is McDonald's. And it is pretty nice if you also have the same greetings and use the same language, all the sorts of things that make sense, especially for big organizations. On the other hand, as you say, you're losing a huge, huge potential for innovation, for change, for improvement, for wonder, for delight, because you're saying, no, we do the greeting like this, and we flip the burger like this, and we ask the customers like this. And if somebody said, what if I did it differently? Then it's much easier in this, in kind of tiny companies are extremely nimble because it takes no time to go from like, okay, here's a good idea, boom, let's try it, and then we're doing it, to flip something like going to a McDonald's and say, what if we went vegan? That might be the best thing McDonald's could ever do. Maybe not now, but in a few years. But it's not exactly going to be a fast turnaround. And when you talked about the turn the ship around book, this is more like turning the super tankers around. And that's slow. But on the other hand, it's pretty nice to have a super tanker at your disposal because there's a lot of, it can fit a lot of stuff.
And this is the thing, like you kind of look and you're like, super tankers are great. But what if we had a small fleet of ships that all carried the same amount of gear? They'd be able to deal with certain things better. But in a rough sea, they'd be potentially worse. In that case, you'd need a super tanker which can stand up to the buffeting of 30, 40, 50 foot waves or whatever it happens to be. So again, you know, I'm sure everyone gets bored of me always going, it's all about the context, but it really is all about the context. So, you know, something with McDonald's, there's a difference, I think, between saying this is how we do things and this is our model and this is how we, you know, this is what we offer. Part of what you do is as a service, which is what McDonald's really, you know, they're offering a service that brings you food. That is done in a specific way. But if you can change the fundamental elements of that to be more efficient and better, and still provide the same veneer, the same end result, the same outcome, that's the parity lies with a lot of companies, because they don't want to look at something that's new because they're so used to doing things that are old. And you eventually end up making decisions. There's this process called first fit mental patterns versus optimal fit, where you make decisions based on past experience, current experience, and projected future experience, usually at an emotional level. Leadership do this, everyone does this, I do this, you'll do this. The difference is whether people are aware of it or not, and whether you can actually push that aside enough to really try an informed decision. And that's very, very hard to do. We think we do it all the time, and we really don't.
And I guess Corona has shown us some wonderful examples. We're right now using Zoom to record this. Why are we using Zoom? Is it because it's the best tool? Probably not. But it's one that I'm familiar with. I know how it functions. You're familiar with it. It's easy. We're getting more and more to the place where you can assume that people know what a Zoom meeting is, which 6 months ago, you couldn't. But now, it's been adopted so widely, and it's very much a winner-takes-all place. Which, because, as you say, first fit instead of optimal fit. I don't even know what's better out there on the market, but I'm sure there are things that are better. I just know that this works because it's minimal effort for me. It's minimal effort for the people I talk to. And that means I'm not going to change it, even if there's something that is objectively better, unless it's really a lot better. And also that it's easier for other people because I'm not only using the tool myself, I'm also, in the McDonald's example, if they made the same burgers but started calling them pileros, then even that simple change, which wouldn't change the meat or the bun or the lettuce, it would still be a huge change because suddenly you're like, what am I eating? What is this? You used to be a burger restaurant. Now it's this pileros. No, I'm going to Burger King. At least there I get a burger. It's like, no, but it's still. And yeah, that is what have been a couple of things that you've done during this time or seen that have just failed? Not because they should, but because humanity.
I've seen quite a few agile transformations that seemed to be working quite well fall on their faces recently. Not just with companies I've been working with, but I've seen this happen because the first human reaction when you're faced with uncertainty is to grope for what you know. Now, I've been developing, as a quick aside, kind of new models for comfort zones. And I don't believe that there's one comfort zone. I think that a lot of people use the term comfort zone relatively incorrectly. Like there's no model is correct, so all models are wrong, but some models are more right than others. And I think seeing one where it says you have to push through the fear zone and you have to push through this other zone and then you get to this growth zone and then you have learning and whatever, but they're great for giving you direction, but they don't actually fit in with how psychologists have doused this for a long time. And I think being able to understand that stepping outside your comfort zone is something that is absolutely required, but you can't step too far, because if you do go into panic and anxiety, it's very rare that you can simply push through that and survive it without serious problems. Very good now is if somebody threw into the deep swimming pool and sink or swim, just walked up, might find a few exceptional people it fitted well with and they learned to swim really well, really quickly. And you'd find a lot of attrition if you did that, right? So the way that we usually learn to swim is consistent incremental progress, just pushing us outside of our comfort. And it's the same with companies. And this gets linked to identities and tribes and various other things in the model. But I think companies also have this thing. And so when you feel uncertain, when you feel discomfort, comfort zones are there for a reason. And I take issue with everyone in saying, just live outside your comfort zone. You need to get outside it all the time. Because whilst I completely agree, and learning is my core essence of being, comfort zones exist for psychological safety. Sometimes you need to rest and you need to recover and you need comfort and psychological safety to just be able to catch your breath before the next round or whatever you're doing or whatever it happens to be. That's why you have holidays, you know, so or vacations or however you want to put it. So, yeah, you know, this is a very human thing. And when you're faced with this, the first thing that most people do is they can accept the challenge, but they will fall back into old structures of dealing with things, of dealing with discomfort. And for companies and for leadership, that means tightening control because you feel like you're losing control. What happens when a pandemic hits and you're effectively sanctioned by the market and the government? You have no control of what is happening to your company. So a lot of very good endeavors that companies have been working on in terms of agility, in terms of cultural transformation, in terms of, you know, leader models and stuff have just gone because suddenly we're in survival mode, you know. And the other thing that I find very interesting, and I do agree with this, is saying this is the opportunity for us to all go and learn something new, companies included. Yes and no, because when you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it depends where you are. And if you are in survival, all you care about is, can we eat? Can we survive? Can we whatever? You don't care about, you radically innovate this company right now. You know, so that's where, again, outside context can help you find certainty and catch your breath, essentially.
I love your swimming pool example, because one of the things that I do in a kind of corporate context is I design meetings. And I look at meetings and I kind of help people make more interesting meetings, whether it's boardrooms or kind of startups or whatever it is, to kind of make their meetings a little bit more lively. And there's an example I sometimes give, which plays very well into this, which is that if you take a meeting, then there are a lot of things we take for granted, that there are going to be chairs, people will be sitting down, there are tables, the light is on, we all have clothes on, we're all allowed to speak. And on the other hand, and that usually people start laughing at the no clothes on remark because we're still humans. And when I say, if you want to experiment with a meeting, it's fine to say, okay, now we're going to turn off the lights and see what that does to our meeting. Or now we're going to all stand up. Or now we're all going to remove the tables. Or you can do any sort of thing. But if you take a meeting and say, okay, we're going to have a meeting. It's going to be Tuesday at 11. And the light is going to be off. We're all going to be naked. There are going to be no chairs. And nobody's allowed to speak. then that may be innovation. But more realistically, anybody who's at that meeting is definitely going to have an experience. But by the time they get there, they're going to have forgotten, is this a budget meeting or why are we even here? And as you say, that if you push it too far, then you end up focusing only on the new stuff and on trying to kind of survive within that instead of on the outcome. And of course, this is in the meetings examples, it's usually something people do because they have a chance and they want to experiment. But here, a lot of people have been forced to do this. They've been forced to work remotely. They've been forced to do big team meetings online. And it's very easy to get caught up in just, do I make sure that the sound works? No matter if the meeting was about budgets or new products or customers or whatever, we get into this, as you say, the control zone of, can I at least make sure that I mute my sound at the right times? And then I forget everything else. Chris, we're soon approaching the half hour mark, which means that you have a chance to round off this episode with a little bit of golden nugget of wisdom. So one big thing that you think, if everybody knew this, then the world would be a better place. No pressure.
So I would probably go with my other thing I say to everyone, and this applies across thing that I do statistically, but it so applies personally as well to everyone. And it's very simple. There is no failure. There is only feedback. The only failure comes from ignoring that feedback and repeating the same mistakes again. When you look statistically at the most successful people, they make the most mistakes very often. They just don't repeat them. So don't be afraid to fail. Arnold Schwarzenegger said this, you know, don't be afraid to fail. Do things as well as you can, but within failure lies the lessons for success. And Edison was a great example of that. He learned 800 however many times of a way not to make a light bulb before he found the one that did. So no failure has zero value. No failure.
I like that also because I'm somebody who has failed and failed and failed again. So it plays very well into my kind of self-narrative. So thank you for that, Chris. To all of you out there, this has been The Business of Extraordinary Experiences. You've heard Chris Bramlin and myself, Klaus Hosting. Thank you for listening.